Hi, Bloodstream listeners. Host Patrick here. It is Thursday, March 12th, 2020, and we are back with another Bloodstream Mini. Today's guest is actor, writer, podcaster, and Health Odyssey survivor. I'm not sure if that's a thing, but that's what I'm going with. Natasha Chandel. Natasha and I worked together on a show called Baker's Dozen, which you can watch right now, or after you listen to the podcast, on Amazon Prime. She's a writer on season 2 of Mr. Iglesias, the Latinx comedy available on Netflix right now. And I've been an on-again, off-again listener to her podcast, Kinda Dating, which she's going to tell you about in just a moment. Natasha's a friend, and I knew a little about her health journey coming into this, but I had no idea how significant a journey it was.
What I did have my first breakdown when they said it was a rare brain disease that had no cure. Then I was like, oh shit, this is real.
Truth be told, I anticipated a 25-30 minute conversation where we mainly talked about entertainment and her career path. Natasha's a great storyteller and she's seasoned on the mic. But as we got into her health odyssey, there was just way too much to talk about. So we went for about an hour. If you're a regular Bloodstream listener who enjoys our health entertainment hybrid show, then I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. And if you're here because you're a fan or a friend of Natasha, I also think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. And if you're neither of those things, I don't know how you got here, but I hope you listen, enjoy, and subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. You can ping Bloodstream Media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can catch old episodes on the Blood Feed YouTube channel, or you can drop us an email, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. As always, the Bloodstream Podcast is made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. Thanks, Takeda, for all you do for people affected by bleeding disorders. Visit bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about that. And shout out to Takeda, who just this week, urged their 50,000 employees to work from home if possible and to avoid all non-essential travel through May 31st in response to COVID-19. That is huge, and it stands to have an impact on upcoming bleeding disorders events. I know the Coalition for Hemophilia B recently canceled a big event, as did the Northern California chapter. I know because I was supposed to be there. This thing continues to demand serious precaution, so kudos to Takeda on that proactive move. Lastly, before we jump into the conversation with Natasha, I was in my home state of New York a couple of weekends ago following Washington Days, and that gave me a chance to catch up with everyone's favorite TV critic, my mother, Mama Sue, RN. Though it wasn't exactly a catch-up that she was ready for, so enjoy that, enjoy the conversation with Natasha, and I'll speak to you again on the other side. Okay, so I'm at my childhood house right now, and my mom is downstairs. My mom, who was a regular contributor to the podcast last year, but I've yet to have on this year, I figured maybe it was time, but I didn't tell her to prepare anything, and she doesn't know I'm about to come downstairs and talk to her, so we're just gonna go surprise her and see what happens. Follow me. Hey, Ma. Did we order the pizza?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that's exciting. He's doing everything. Wait, hold on one second, because I'm actually recording something for the pod. No, that's good. But what are you doing here? Why don't you tell the podcast listeners what's going on in your house?
I'm redoing my kitchen right now, so my uncle just called me to give me a suggestion about a microwave.
Yeah, what did he have to say?
He said I should get a microwave that matches the stove that I have, not just any microwave.
How do you feel? You can't see this, but she's making a lot of faces.
I know this is super exciting to the audience.
Well, they haven't heard from you in a minute.
I know. Well, I'm sorry they're hearing about this.
Is there something you'd prefer to tell them about?
No, I'm fine.
People like to hear about kitchens getting redone. People get their kitchens redone. It's a thing that happens in life.
I know, but I've never done it. It's a lot of work and a lot of research.
It's been a long time coming, though. It must feel good to finally be getting to that stage.
Oh, it does, yes, and it's fun. It's fun.
So what have you been watching lately? We haven't caught up with you about what's been streaming on TV. I know you're not prepared and you haven't been doing your research, but just give us a sense of what you've had on.
Well, what I've been watching, which is very current, is I've been watching the series. I don't know if it's on Netflix or Amazon. Pandemic, which is only just made in January. It's a six series show, and it's all about the pandemic and the coronavirus and around the different countries, how they're trying to battle it. It's very interesting, actually. I would recommend it.
What are some of the things that you've seen take place at your hospital since the coronavirus outbreak has hit the news waves?
Actually, the staff are not doing anything. We're not wearing masks or anything, but I work in a predominantly Chinese neighborhood, and all the Chinese patients and family members come in with masks, but we're not wearing any masks. So we have had one rule out case that was admitted with flu-like symptoms. We isolated them in somewhere up an inpatient area, but it was ruled out, and they went home, you know, with just a regular flu they had. So I guess we're going to, you know, if it gets more serious or more cases are confirmed, we'll be taking different methods. But right now we're not doing anything different.
Does this remind you at all of other viruses? It seems like every year or 2 years, there's some, like, it was H1N1, like one of them, or like bird flu. And there's like, it seems like there every, there's like always like, some, is this like those or is it different at the hospital?
It's a little different because it just seems so sudden with deaths around the world. Like Ebola is still out there. It's always been out there for a little while. For a hot minute, it was a big thing. And we instituted all kinds of things that we never used. And Ebola just quietly seems to have gone away, although it's still out there in low numbers. So I guess these viruses surge and mutate, and coronavirus probably will never go away. But right now it's on a peak. And until they can really control it and get some kind of vaccine or treatment, there is really no treatment for flus and viruses.
Well, on a brighter note, just one other quick thing. We were talking about it earlier. The National Organization of Rare Disorders, used to be Rare Diseases, now it's Rare Disorders, is honoring some people, myself included, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this May, which means that you get to come to be part of that, but it also means you get to visit for the first time the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Which, as I've said to you in the past, was on my wish list, so I'm very excited to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to seeing there, or an exhibit, or a period of time, anything like that?
The 70s, when I grew up. All those great rockers. I want to see them all.
Well, I'm glad that my work in rare disease has given you that opportunity.
Plus, I'll see you when you award, so it'll be great.
Well, thanks for letting me ambush you here, Mom.
You're very welcome.
I don't think that's true, but I appreciate you being a good sport.
Thank you.
Joining me now on Bloodstream is my friend, actor, writer, comedian. I could go on, but I'll let you do that in a moment. Natasha Chandel from the Kinda Dating podcast and writer on, it's still a new show, Mr. Iglesias, right? We're just done with season one only, right?
Yeah, season one is on Netflix and season two is going to come out this summer. Hi,
oh, cool.
Friends.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. You've been busy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so have you.
Yeah, well, but they know me. They don't know you. So let's start with, well, I guess give people a little background. You are an actor. You are a writer. You have this podcast. You're a multi-hyphenate artist and talent producer, everything. Give people a little bit of an overview, and then I'd love to hear about season one of Mr. Iglesias.
Oh, yeah. So I'm a producer, writer, actor, kind of moved out of the producing world finally last year to follow my real dream. And so, you know, have had a wonderful, blessed career as a producer at some big networks, and then was like, I want to do my writing thing and acting thing, and that's all that makes me really happy. And so kind of started focusing on that. I got staffed on Netflix's Mr. Iglesias with Gabriel Iglesias, a.k.a. Fluffy. Because sometimes I say Gabriel Iglesias and people just stare at me. And then I'm like, Fluffy? And they're like, Fluffy! I'm like, yeah, him.
How did that come to be?
It's a very interesting story. So I didn't apply for it. And I didn't know it was happening. So one of the EPs, which in industry talk is executive producer of the show, is a friend of mine through my podcast. And
Kinda Dating.
And last year, he ended up, sorry, not last year because now it's 2020. So 2018, you know, part of the writing thing is like you share your sample with other industry people when you think it's ready. And so I asked him, like, hey, do you think, you know, I really value your opinion. Do you think you could take a look at the sample? He said, yes. I didn't know that season one was already in production. So he said yes, but I never heard from him. Okay. And writing etiquette is you're not allowed to ask. You're not allowed to ask again.
Just goes into the ether. You keep your fingers crossed.
I just said no. I was like, all right, he's busy. Yeah. Probably didn't read it. Moving on. And really weirdly, last summer, right before Labor Day, I get an email suddenly from Peter, is his name, Peter Murrieta, and he sent me an email going like, are you free for breakfast with Kevin Hench and I next week? And I was like, who's Kevin Hench? And I didn't know anything, and he didn't say what the breakfast was about. So I was like, should I ask? And then I was kind of in this like, no, just go with the flow kind of zone.
Nice.
And I literally just asked him, I was like, anything I should know? And he goes, you know, I don't know, watch season one and be funny. People forget to be funny. And I was like, okay.
Interesting.
Still have no idea what this is about.
Okay.
So I go for this breakfast. We talk an hour and a half. Nothing about a job.
Wow.
And then partway through, Kevin was like, so tell me about the sample you wrote. And I was like, oh my God. So he's read. Oh, fuck. What? Oh, all right. So like, I was completely thrown, and we just ended up having this conversation about that. Still nothing about a job. And then the breakfast finishes. Peter texts me going, you did great. I'm like, I don't know what I did great at. All right. By lunch, I got the offer. And they're like, we'd like you to start on Tuesday. And so I had to close the deal by end of the day. And we had to start on Tuesday. And that was like Thursday before Labor Day weekend. And so I started Tuesday.
Wow. So you had a business day and some hours.
Yeah. And like, thank God I had a lawyer ready.
Yeah, no kidding.
I was like, oh my gosh.
Wow.
So, I think it's just a much weirder example. I think most writers submit and have formal interviews and all this kind of stuff. And this is just something that I feel like, wow, the universe just brought it all together.
So they had you watch season one. They hired you on for season two then.
Yes,
and had they already hired the other writers? Were they filling a gap? It does sound like if you were starting on Tuesday and this is the end of day Thursday and you've got to like wrap it up and it's Labor Day weekend, it sounds like they were in a pinch of some kind, were they?
So I heard later, because I thought so too, but they were like, no, your name had been around for a long time. Kevin was already pretty sure he was going to move forward with you.
Oh,
and so I think
like
it's why
opposite
they...
opposite almost, where it was like taken for granted in a way.
In a little way. One thing did open up that there were two new writers, one a senior level writer, another co-EP, and then myself as like a more lower level writer, as they're called. And so both of us were added on at the end.
Gotcha.
And I think it was also because, from what I've heard, they didn't get the green light for season two till much later.
Mm.
And so all of those pieces had to come together. And then when they realized, well, this is how much budget we have left. We have space for two new writers, one senior, one not. And so then it kind of went from there. But then everybody was like, no, your name had been around. They were gunning for you. I was like, oh, all right. So I think it was more of like a personality test by that point.
And so you were then in the room and writing as part of the staff. But I also saw plenty of videos from your Instagram on set. So you were in the room and on set throughout the process?
So most of the day from like Monday, in the daytime, so from 10 to 6, we're in a room. A lot of people ask what it's like inside a writer's room.
Yeah.
This is my first one, and I find it very funny because... I think most writers' rooms have windows at least.
Oh, God.
We were in a boardroom at Netflix with no windows from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And we left for 10 minutes a day to go get coffee from the Netflix building and like came back to our room. And and it's a comedy room, so you have to be on the whole day.
Right.
And like if it's not about story, you got to be funny. Or you got to be contributing to something, you know? So it's like...
And not suffering from a lack of sunlight.
Yeah. So it was insane. And like, you can't be on your phone too much. And so it's like a very weird...
It's intense.
Yeah. Kind of insular experience in a way. It was...
How many in the room? How many people in that room?
There were 9 of us in total.
What was the male-female split?
We're a very good, diverse room. So
nice.
It was 6 guys, 3 women, one... very senior, she's been writing for 20 years on comedies, to 2 of us who are a little bit younger. It's a Latinx show,
right?
So the room was 6 Latinx writers, 2 white guys, and me as an Indian girl,
right on.
All different ages, backgrounds. It was really great. I just feel like this was like probably like what a real diverse room should be like.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
What did you learn coming out of that you could never have expected?
I really didn't think it would be that intense. So one thing, like I joke to my other writer friends, because I have a girlfriend, she writes on Insecure, and you know, me and her go way back, like we were in the same improv team together, and so when she obviously started doing more with Insecure, her schedule got busier. So when I would be like, hey, could we grab coffee? The same thing that now people ask me. She would be like, can we do a phone call? And I remember going like, oh, really, bitch? Like, can I curse on this?
It's fine. All yeah, right, we have sound effects. All right.
I was like, oh, really? Like, you're going to do a phone call with me? Okay, fine. And it would be like 8:45 a.m. phone call. I was like, really, ooh, girl? Okay. Like, why are we doing this? And then now fast forward, I ended up emailing her being like, girl, I got it. Like, I had to end up only meeting people for breakfast.
Right.
Or it was a very rare evening drinks kind of thing.
Just because,
you're so tired mentally by the end of the day that I can't talk anymore.
Well, and it also, as you just alluded to, people reach out to you asking if they can meet for a coffee or a meal once you've been staffed on Mr. Iglesias, and they then see themselves, you know, maybe it's a young American, Indian American writer who's like, I see myself, I want to talk to you, but now you're busier. So it's like, yeah, as the interest goes up, your availability goes down, and you want, I'm saying you, and yet I totally have this experience as well, have to say no, or have to say, could we in 3 weeks, or could we do it this way instead, more often than, you know, I for one feel comfortable with, but I've had to learn to live with that discomfort, which it sounds like you have as well. So that's the writing side of you a bit. Tell me how you decided to start the Kinda Dating podcast.
So we call it Kinda Dating because nobody says they're in a relationship anymore. And, you know, the whole premise is cool guests and I break down one dating topic per episode and we try to figure out why everybody has commitment issues. I started it because, one, I wanted to do a podcast. The medium was blowing up and I was like, well, what could I provide? And what I was known for was my perspective on dating because I used to be a hardcore relationship girl who became a massive commitment phobe after a really abusive relationship. Mm. And so for 5.5 years, I became the can't beat him, join him. Mm. So I literally did, like, I didn't consider myself, like, I never lied to anybody. It would be like on date one, I'd be like, I don't want to be your girlfriend. Cool, you do you, I do me. Awesome, great. Like, I don't need to ask you, don't check up on me. Just, like, we're going to hang when we hang, like, do you.
Yeah.
And no fail, they would always be like, will you be my girlfriend? I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, you think this is reverse psychology. It's not. You do you, I'm going to do me. So the answer is no. And, But in doing that, like, I was openly dating people. So yeah. I always just sort of joke that I was a player and they didn't even know it.
Right.
But because I know that side, then I kind of became out of it and realized, like, how unfulfilled I was. Mm. And so I came out as sort of a reformed commitment phobe, which is where I am now.
Okay.
Which is, like, I still feel the tendencies of sometimes wanting to run. But I have fought through a lot of it. Thank God for therapy.
Oh, pardon the host here. What Bing. An unprofessional. My goodness.
It's okay. You could have blamed it on me. Nobody would have known.
No, I would never do such a thing while you're sharing something that's funny. I would like the audience. Okay, now please continue. That won't happen again.
No, all good. So yeah. And then, so basically I started the podcast because I had come out of all of this. My idols are Oprah and Tina Fey, like literally my two. And my approach to anything I create is entertain and enlighten. Those are my two words that I use for myself. Mm. And so I was like, well, what can I do that would be funny for people, would be relatable, but would also get people to learn without an advice show?
Yeah.
Because as a millennial, we don't like being told what to do.
No, we do not.
And so I hate it. So on the podcast, I'm like, I'm never going to tell anybody what to do. And like, this is the way,
right,
you know,
right.
I'm like, there are multiple ways, but hey, here's us exploring and having a discussion about it. And you take what works for you and what doesn't. But my whole goal was to tell people the things I wish somebody told me when I was young, because I came out of so many bad relationships. Actually, I should say that not all bad relationships, but I dated people that were not a good fit for me, and people who brought me down a lot. And so a big thing for me is to empower people to make decisions that are right for them, and to stop looking at it like, oh, my whole life is like, if I tell people, I'm like, don't go on a date going, how do I make him happy? Go on a date going, does he make me happy?
Absolutely.
And so that kind of changes the dynamic of like how you're approaching something. And two, dating isn't hard. Dating is not difficult. Being half a human with somebody for an hour of your life isn't hard.
Say being half a human?
Yeah, like I'm saying at the very least, right, you know, right, being half a human. It's like, let's give people the worst case scenario.
Sure.
It's not difficult. What's hard is managing your feelings around it. Right. So it's like how a date goes badly, we internalize all of it, and very quickly everything turns into, I'm going to die alone.
Yes.
Anything that happens, like, oh my God, I laughed at that joke. I shouldn't have laughed. Oh my God, this is why I'm going to die alone. Like, it just goes so, like, we just spiral.
Yes.
Oh my God, you know, I just didn't, there was no chemistry.
You're going to die
alone. This is what is going to happen. I'm going to die alone. You know, and everything comes to that. So I try to manage people's like, hey, maybe let's work on that part and not the date. Like, worry about dating being this horrible thing that we have to partake in.
You know, that reminds me of the Alexander technique, which I was introduced to in acting school by Betsy Politan. Shout out to Betsy Politan. And as she would put it simply, the Alexander technique was about making choices so that we were not subject to our physical and mental habits and getting stuck in the same loops. And obviously, as an actor, that helps one find some state of quote unquote neutral so that you can make choices about who a character is and not just a default to like, this is how Patrick responds to things. This is how Patrick moves his arms. This is how his voice does his thing. It sounds like the same kind of idea in what you're describing. It's sneaking into that space between the thing you can't control, which is the actual event of the date, or the moment, and that thought that leads to a feeling that leads to a behavior that becomes a spiral. It's sneaking into that vulnerable little space in the middle and making a fully empowered choice. Very difficult in the moment, but as I, in the last couple of years, especially for my own anxiety and depression management, have tried to recognize that space between a trigger, a thought process starting, and like the thought manufacturing facility just starting to go, 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 go. Now feelings are emerging and they're real because they're being produced by real thoughts, but it's all this big internal thing that gets further and further away from the empirical event that triggered it the more I just let myself run. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I hear that.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I do say on the podcast is like, life is a series of choices. If you want something to change in your life, make better choices. And at the end of the day, it just comes from a choice. And I can say this from a person who used to be a codependent, who has dated guys who are controlling, who were addicts, who always attracted this person. I had to go, wait, what the fuck? What the heck is wrong with my choices? And so whenever people ask me, like, how are you single? My truthful answer is I had bad judgment. And my bad judgment was based on me making not good choices for me. I always let people convince me into things I didn't really want to be in. And so now I'm in a very different place, and I've come out of all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, it was a joke that, like, my ex, like, my last serious relationship, he and I were living together, and it was right before the podcast had launched.
Okay.
And so I was like, oh, I'm coming from this great place. Like, I'll be able to talk about how I got in this relationship now as a commitment phobe. He cheated on me. It was completely fine. It's a very funny story. It's part of my stand-up now. But he cheated on me with grandmas. So, yeah.
What?
Yeah, let that sink in for a sec. Yeah.
Okay, I guess we have to just keep going for now.
Yeah.
We have to go watch you do stand-up
totally.
To find out more?
Watch my stand-up. It's a true story. And so then, you know, when I finally, like, I ended it really quickly. And what I loved and was so proud about on my side was I didn't revert back. I knew it had nothing to do with me. And I don't care what anybody even remotely tries to think, because, you know, there is a whole stigma around, like, if you get cheated on, people think, well, something must have been wrong with her that he cheated on her.
Sure.
But you're like, well, if you know the story, you know, it had nothing to do with me. And I'm not going to internalize this. And so when I came out of it, my friends were all like, please don't go back to old Tash. Like, I had multiple friends tell me that.
Yeah.
And that was like commitment phobe Tash who would go play a dude. Like, because, you know, I was like, oh, no, I'm done with that life. Like,
good.
That I came out of it like laughing. And I was like, well, that was silly.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very hard thing to go through. I can imagine. But I think the point you're making is fantastic that you were able to not revert. And again, life
but
is
it was
going
a choice.
To throw, right. And you were able to make that empowered choice before a thought process started and you internalized something that wasn't yours to carry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I'm still just like, what, grandma's?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
all right.
Then afterwards I had to look back and be like, oh, that's why you fucking brought those extra flowers for my mom. That's why you fucking took her shopping when I was out of town.
Yikes.
I was like,
wow.
Thank God I trust my mom.
I'll leave that there.
Yeah.
You've done over 100 episodes of Kind. When did you start the podcast?
3 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've done 134 episodes.
Wow. So I'm curious to know if health has come up as a topic, and I imagine at some point it has, and I guess I'll say this. When I was dating as somebody with hemophilia, I was never bashful about my diagnosis. And I used to joke with people that, like, how long would it take until hemophilia would come up on a first date? Because I have the thing, I work in the space, my brother's name is tattooed on my wrist who hadn't passed from hemophilia. Like, I have a medical alert bracelet. It's kind of all over me. So I could not get that far into a date without it coming up from one angle or another. Fun fact, a guy who now works for me full time, this is like 6 years ago, he was still working for me a lot as a freelancer. And when I was sharing this with him once, he was like, well, if it makes you feel any better, it comes up on every one of my first dates too. And I was like, okay, that helps. That is good. But it's been pointed out to me in retrospect, and as I've reflected, I'm certain at times it was at least one of the things that maybe didn't lead to a second date.
Mm-hmm.
In a couple few spots where I think back, and I was certainly interested in a second date, felt like there was a connection. But then in sort of like doing my own postmortem, wondering like, all right, you never know. Somebody could be busy. Maybe they were just being very nice, but they weren't feeling mm-hmm. the same thing. But I'm kind of certain that at least in a couple cases, the like hemophilia.
I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
Like
once upon a time, people got HIV with it. I don't know how, but I don't want AIDS. So I don't have to see you for a second date. Have you both in your experience and as a host on Kind of Dating, encountered people for whom their like health odyssey or health story impacted how they went about dating?
Yes, we did an episode on dating with an illness, and we had a guest on who had Tourette, and so sort of her experience. We've had stories be told, you know, where somebody went on a date with somebody who they didn't know was blind, I think, or had like a physical disability, like a pretty serious one.
That they didn't know before the
date. That they didn't know. We're actually trying, I would love to have you on because we're this year trying to do an episode specifically on dating with, though, you know, I don't like to use the word disability, but like that kind of thing where I have a girlfriend who recently, you know, in the last like 2 years, became a multiple sort of amputee where she lost both her legs and almost all her fingers
it's
from
the only
a disease.
Minority population that any of us could join at any time.
Yeah, yeah. And hers was so crazy. She just went on a hike and caught some rare infection on the hike in Vancouver and came back in a coma and, you know, had to get all this happen.
Unbelievable.
And so that's something like we do want to do an episode on because we do have people reaching out saying like, oh, I deal with a disability and people don't want to date
me. I'm glad people reaching out talking to you
about that. Yeah. And so it's something that I've just wanted to tackle properly and get the right people on it with, you know, a sort of ideally a positive perspective. That is something that I'm very cautious about with guests. Like a lot of people hit me up and they're like, I would be a great guest. I have the worst dating stories. I'm like, yeah, that's probably why you are not going to be on my show. Because, you know, you want to leave people feeling like there's hope in the world. So I talk about it because I used to have Lyme disease for 7 years undiagnosed. So I got it towards the end of college. And so I ended up missing my, you know, acute Lyme when it's like very active.
Yeah. Can you give the top line of Lyme disease for anyone who might not be familiar?
Oh, yeah. Lyme disease is a infectious disease that you get from an infected tick. If a tick bites you in your spine, is the worst place to get Lyme because it just moves through your central nervous system.
Sure.
That is where I got the tick bite. We just didn't know because, so I'm from Ontario, Canada. Ontario is known for ticks.
Okay.
But I got it in India, and India is not known for Lyme disease. Like, it's so rare there. But I had gone to a, it's called a hill station. It's like a little resort kind of thing at the top of a mini mountain.
Okay.
And it was in like a foresty area. And so I must have gotten it there. Wow. And I mean, we diagnosed it 7 years later when I finally had to look back where anybody was like, did you ever get an insect bite?
So I just didn't. 7 years. Like, yeah. What were you experiencing over those 7 years without a diagnosis?
Lyme is terrible. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Mm. It basically mimics, so in the beginning, it's like pneumonia level sickness where I was extremely ill. I was under 3 blankets, shaking. In 2 weeks, I lost, you know, 6 or 12 pounds or something like that. Like, you just, it feels like I ended up going to a naturopath at that point, just in the beginning, because we just didn't know what was wrong.
Yeah,
I just thought I caught something weird in India. And like, we did some meridian tests, and they were like, literally all your organs are like not working right now. We don't know how you're functioning. And it was true. Like, I couldn't walk. I couldn't. So the hardest ones are chronic exhaustion. You get I was sleeping for about 18 hours. Like, I couldn't.
How often was that the case in those 7 years that you were sleeping 18 hours
a
day?
The first 2 years was really bad.
Oh my God.
And so I missed like my last year of university. I couldn't physically get up to go anymore because I was just tired. And so my professors had, all I told them was like, look, we're trying to figure out why I'm ill. I'm ill.
Yeah.
I can't physically be in class, but I will do all the assignments and whatever. But like in one case, I actually missed the final exam. Because I didn't know there was a final exam. They'd swapped in between the final essay for an exam.
Sure.
So I was like, what? I've never gotten a D in my life, and now I have a D. I'm like, okay. But, you know, it is body pain from head to toe. So I used to be like doubled up. It's before this, I was never sick. I didn't get a cold. I couldn't get anything.
Hmm.
And it's where I developed anxiety because I didn't, my body was in so much pain that I would be doubled up and I'd start hyperventilating. And and because of that, my body started in this really terrible stress loop of the stress caused the pain caused the stress, it caused the anxiety. Like, it just kept looping.
Yeah.
And then as it progresses, it starts affecting different organs. So I would just have really bad heart palpitations. I had muscle failure. So I was a dancer. I would like stand there in a dance pose and suddenly I couldn't move. And I was like, what the fuck?
That's so scary.
Yeah, it's just like weird things, like really intense stomach pain, like stabbing all day. So I couldn't eat a lot. I lost a lot of weight. The tiredness. And then at the worst times, they thought that I had cancer because I had lost so much weight in such a short amount of time.
Sure.
I couldn't eat all the stuff. So they checked me for cancer. Then they thought I had MS because I started having gait issues and I couldn't, like, I would drive to a job and I couldn't drive back. So my parents would have to like come out of their way, and I worked like 40 minutes away as a producer, and I had to quit the job because I can't have my family.
So how did you find, I mean, this sounds like such a hellscape to go through for 7 years, and at the end of college, beginning of a professional career, you have to quit your job. How did you finally get a diagnosis of Lyme disease?
So it eventually, the last thing that started happening, so eventually at one point plateaued. Once they said that, they thought I had a rare brain disease that had no cure.
Wow.
And that six doctors in North America could diagnose.
Just to have to hear those things over and over, like psychologically, how much stress that adds to an already stressful situation.
What's so interesting, because I think I had a weird approach to this Lyme thing. I wasn't stressed most of the time. I was very like just accepting that something was going on and I had to figure it out. What I did have my first breakdown when they said it was a rare brain disease that had no cure. Then I was like, oh shit, this is real. Like, what is happening? And that was when I had a breakdown. Then I ended up meeting these doctors. They said I didn't. But they were like, we still don't know what's wrong. Science is a practice. You know, if you get really tired, we hate to say this to you, but bring a pillow. And jeez. I was like, okay, bring a pillow to work. Great,
that's,
cool.
That's the medical advice.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm 23 at this point. So I was like, what is happening? Hey. But I was also so relieved that I didn't have this disease that I just up and left. I left Toronto. I moved to New York. And I was like, I'll figure it out. Like, I just need to live my life.
Yeah.
So I've always had this very, like, any day I'm alive, I just live my life kind of approach. Hmm. But when I started getting in New York, I developed a fainting spell. And so I would faint and for whatever reason couldn't walk for 2 weeks. So I would just lose the ability in my legs to walk. But because I had been a dancer for so many years, I was a dancer and teacher for 10 years, they said you're forcing your legs to move when they shouldn't be moving. So they eventually got me to check for periodic paralysis.
Okay.
Now this is, let's fast forward, 7 years in.
Okay.
So there was this one doctor back home in Canada at a big hospital. They're like, he will check you for periodic paralysis. And I was like, okay. And waited 6 months for this appointment. And, you know, in between, I think the hardest parts is something we were talking about off mic, is like they ask you weird questions like, well, you look fine. Are you sure something's going on? Like, you look great.
Yeah.
And especially as an actor, sometimes I would come from an audition to a doctor's appointment, so my face looks done.
Sure.
But they're like, they don't know what I've been going through all day, but they are just like, you look good. And then I would get a lot of the like, are you sure you're not depressed? Like, are you going through stuff? I'm like, I'm going through stuff because I'm sick.
Right, like, right, exactly.
That's why I'm depressed and anxious. Like, yeah.
We have a stuttering documentary called My Beautiful Stutter, and there's a speech pathologist in it who speaks to this very point for people who stutter. There are those who will say, well, you must just be anxious, or you just are like nervous as a public speaker. It's like, no, I'm anxious because I have a stutter.
Yeah.
It's not causing my stutter. I'm anxious because you're staring at me this way.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Do you think part of that had to do with your being a woman?
I don't know if it had to do with me being specifically a woman. Maybe I think it just had to do with the way I looked.
Okay.
I do, and maybe that comes down to being a woman. I don't know. I think that they felt she looks fine.
Yeah.
And that's always sort of been my battle because I fight a lot. Like I push my body to do things it shouldn't probably do. I was also very like, I was sick for so long, I had to act like I was fine because people didn't know. People felt so uncomfortable around me.
Yes.
My friends didn't know what was wrong. I didn't tell a single person. My best friend since I was 7 found out how bad I was maybe 5 years ago.
That must have been
and
so lonely.
She started crying. She was like, I can't believe you had been going through this and didn't tell me.
Yeah.
I'm like, because what was I going to tell you? Like, I can't walk for 2 weeks suddenly. I just didn't show up to school. And so I just didn't tell people.
The script,
yeah.
Like if it was her.
Yeah.
And she told you, you would be the one being like, how could you not tell me you weren't walking for 2 weeks?
100%.
Like we do this to ourselves. We don't want to ask for help or let people in. And, you know, I share with you, if I may be so bold, some amount of intimacy avoidance. Yeah. I have abandonment issues. Mm-hmm. I think there's some things we share when it comes to like, I'm going to run away from this rather than commit to it. And through my relationship to Natalie and our marriage, I've had to face some of that stuff really intimately that still lingers from stuff as a child, the death of my brother, name the past trauma. So I am also someone who takes on too much and would be slow to let people in. And yet I hear you say it and it's like, yeah, but if it was your friend, and I'm also the kettle here is calling the pot black because I am much the same way. And it's, you know why? It's funny. We societally are not very comfortable with sickness and illness. We don't know how to engage with friends or loved ones who aren't feeling well. And then even ourselves, when I feel sick, I don't know how to operate from a place of sickness. Like you, I have behaved as though everything is fine, even when it hasn't been, because what am I going to do? Crumble under the depression of my brother's death? No, I'm going to show up to that audition, book the gig, and then do a great job. How? Because I'm going to make a conscious choice to like live in this moment. What I have come to appreciate now in my mid-30s is that if at no point I stop to appreciate the gravity of those events and really take the time to permit processing and healing, they stick around and get involved in all of these insidious and undercover ways. They become out of my control. 100%. Whereas when they come into the light and I can look and point and write down what it is and think about, then I have a chance to make a different decision. It goes back to that conscious choice we were talking about earlier, to make a different decision about how to respond to something. So I'm so sorry, though, for 7 years that you had that on your shoulders by yourself. That must have been extremely lonely.
I had my parents. My parents were the only people who knew everything top to bottom because they took me to all my appointments. But it was difficult in New York because I was alone. I was in a different country. And especially when I had a fainting spell, it was very difficult to explain to people why I couldn't walk. And so I would have to show up to work. I was working at MTV. I had to leave an hour early because I was literally walking slower than a senior on a walker. But I would force my legs to move even when they weren't supposed to get to work. And then I would just sit. And nobody knew, because I knew the second anybody knew, not only do I become a liability at work, people start being weird with you. And I was like, I just don't need this attention because I already don't know what's wrong.
Yeah.
But eventually when I met this doctor, I have sort of an infuriating story where, but wonderful, that a resident doctor is the first person who saw me and interviewed me for an hour and a half. And I happened to be very luckily in the middle of a spell where I had just fainted like 2 days before and I couldn't walk.
Okay.
So it's very rare for a doctor to have been able to see me in that state.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one who saw me and was like, you're not supposed to move. I see you're shaking. And because he was like, bend down and come up. And I was like, and I did it. And he was like, I could tell you're not even supposed to do that. And he was just so moved by me being so young and being in this state that he talked to me for an hour and a half. The regular doctor came in, saw me for 10 minutes, said, you don't have periodic paralysis, and left. And I was like, what? I waited 6 months. Can you just tell me anything more? Could anything? Nothing. He just, that's it. Walked away. I was so upset. And then went back to New York. This resident doctor called me 2 weeks later and he said, you know, I just couldn't get you out of my head. Like, you're too young. You shouldn't have been going through this.
Good for him.
Have you ever checked for Lyme disease? And at this point, I have had every test done to me known to man. Like, I used to get, when they used to do my blood tests, I've had 12 vials, like giant vials taken at one time, just them testing everything. And I've had lupus tests, cameras up in everywhere, like, everything done, CTs, MRIs, MRAs, dye, so I don't know, like everything. And so I literally didn't know. I was like, I don't know. I feel like they've tested everything. I don't remember that specific one. He goes, can you just do me a favor and just get it tested again? We got it tested again. It was the only thing that ever came half positive.
Huh.
So Lyme is a very difficult test.
Okay.
And so they didn't do the actual real blood test. They did like the first level test.
Sure.
And they deemed it as a false positive. So they're like, no, she doesn't actually have Lyme, because what would happen is they'd have to quarantine me. They'd have to figure out where this tick came from. I was in a different country.
I see.
I was like, fuck you guys.
Yeah.
I then ended up we found out what the treatment for Lyme is, and the first round is a 21-day antibiotic called doxycycline and a high dose of it, so 500 mg.
Okay.
They wouldn't give it to me in Canada, so we got it ordered in from India. And my mom was like, fuck these guys. I'm sorry. I just have to say it. She was like, F them. We're going to get this medicine because this is the only thing. And then I finally looked up Lyme. I had every single thing down the list of what could happen to somebody with Lyme. And I was like, wow. I have never read anything that was like, this is me. Because like they were checking for lupus, all these things. I was like, I don't have a lot of these things.
But you're looking at these symptoms. This, you're like, I'm like, this is it.
Oh my God, every single thing.
Yeah.
And so then we got this 21-day antibiotic, immediately got better.
Which is, of course, wonderful, but on some level, so infuriating, right? Like, yeah. In 21...
Where I was like a 21-day antibiotic. And I'm lucky in the sense that I think my body was so clean before. I've never done drugs. I didn't drink. I didn't take medication. So I think that the antibiotics worked.
Right.
But my immunity was so low. Like I was getting sick every 10 days because Lyme just kills your immunity. And so when I finally got better, the first things that changed, I stopped having to nap. Immediately, I had energy. Immediately, I wasn't tired the way I was.
Yeah.
And immediately, my immunity went up. I wasn't getting sick. And then it took about like a year for my body to fully sort of get back to normal. And now, you know, it's been many years, almost like 9 years. And I have very few things. Like I have some things you can't reverse. Like I have joint problems in my knees now.
Oh, what's up? Lexi's like. Lexi's like joint problems.
Yeah,
we're very accustomed to those in this community
exactly.
of bleeders.
Yeah. So like those things I can't change now.
Yeah.
I do need rest. I am somebody who needs to have at least 8 hours of sleep or I don't.
That's reasonable.
You know,
though.
My
That's
head doesn't function
crazy.
All that well and my body doesn't work. So now it's much limited. I've had to change my diet. I can't eat certain things.
What kind
still.
Of things do you have to avoid?
I'm on something called a low FODMAP diet.
Okay.
So a lot of things.
Okay.
Like mushrooms, anything aged I can't eat.
Okay. Like cheese aged?
Yeah, like aged cheese I can't. I can have mozzarella, but I can't have blue cheese.
Gotcha.
A lot of different vegetables. So those kinds of intolerances happened over that time and they've just sort of stuck around. And so I'm like, that's fine.
Right. It's knowable.
Yeah. But like the girl who slept all the time and my friends knew not to call her for 3 hours in a day because I would be taking a nap.
Right.
That I rarely take a nap now.
Wow.
Like I just.
What an odyssey. Sleep. Like that's, nuts. I had no idea that's like not a small part of your life. That's a major.
Yeah.
It's funny with hemophilia, it's chronic. I've had it my whole life. I will have it. But there were 7 years from 7 to 14-ish where, long story short, my immune system was rejecting the medicine. So it makes life with hemophilia very difficult.
Oh my God.
And it was a 7-year period. And it wasn't until about 2 or 3 years ago, I'm forgetting now, that I was being asked about that more specifically. And I realized how much of that I kind of blocked out and just don't think about because it was really hard. And whenever I could, I tried not to think about it. And like, as you were saying earlier, put on the good face and go do whatever I could do for as long as I could do it. And since 14, I've just kept running. So
you might find this interesting. Have you ever heard of this author, Eckhart Tolle?
Oh, yeah.
So he talks about in his book, A New Earth, I think it was so one of the other reasons I have, you know, a lot of people have met me and they're like, man, you're like so much wiser than your years. And I think it's because of having gone through that. But I remember being 21, lying in bed, thinking the pain was so much from head to toe that this was it. And I was actually literally thinking about the funeral because I couldn't get up. My mom was feeding me rice every day because I couldn't eat. I literally couldn't lift a spoon to eat.
Yeah,
food.
You sound like an elderly person.
Yeah,
in hospice.
And so she was like sitting there feeding me, and I was like, "All right, well, like this is it."
Yeah.
But I remember reading his book, A New Earth, which is I've now read 4 times, and is literally the thing that changed my life and perspective, especially at that time. But he explained it of why people with illness have these kinds of more wise sort of perspectives because. When normal life is happening to us, to any person, we have energy, and energy allows us to take in a lot of shit. And when we are in the middle of an acute illness, like probably from 7 to 14 for you, our energy level drops and our body goes into what is a priority of for me to focus on.
Yes.
And it doesn't become a lot of times a negativity because we don't have time for it. Or we don't have time to not function. All we have the energy for is to do the things that we can manage.
That's so interesting.
And then as we start getting better is when the negativity starts coming back, because now we have the energy and room to bring this really shitty part back in. But if we start going back and like remembering the priorities, we go, oh, this stuff isn't a priority. So like one thing with me is like a lot of people ask me, they're like, how do you have this like kind of energy for life? And I'm always like, because I have a day to breathe. Yeah. I have a day to be functional. I'm going to use it. So I end up doing a lot, probably like you, like doing a lot in our days because we have the ability to do it.
Yeah.
But in those times, I have to consciously be like, do you want to go down this path, which I have. We've all gone through it. I've gone through depression, like serious bouts of depression and anxiety of being sick and whatever. But I've always realized that the healthier I get, the more negativity comes back in because I have space for
That's
it.
That's such a great thing to be aware of. And I've always thought of myself as a bit utilitarian. And I think to your point, when sick and having to prioritize, or I guess to Eckhart Tolle's point, when being sick and having to prioritize, there's just not room for that other crap. So that probably has as much to do with my quote unquote utilitarian, functionally driven behavior as anything. I have never thought about how with more energy comes the capacity to take in more of the crap and more of the noise and negativity of the world. And I certainly get to, I definitely wind up being overloaded with that stuff. And then I recognize like, oh, I'm stressed, but it's like already a few steps later than it needs to be. And I am going to walk away from this now sensitive to like energy equals the capacity to absorb negativity as much as it does positivity.
Yeah.
So I have to stay sensitive of that. That's a really great point.
And another great, there's this monk named Dandapani, and he talks about energy as currency, which I found to be really great. It's kind of what helped change a lot of the trajectory of my life in the last 2 years, because he says like, imagine your currency like $100 bill. You know, where are you going to spend that $100? And so if all you have is $100 to encompass your entire life, with who are you going to spend it? How are you going to spend it? Focus on what? And so like that ends up making you go, oh, yeah, wait, do I want? No, I don't. Like this, if I have $100, you don't.
My immediate, you don't get in on that. Yeah. My immediate knee jerk to that is like, I wouldn't even do that exercise because I already know I'm spending $200. Like, I already know I'm $100 in debt. I can't even do the exercise.
Yeah. I get it.
So I have kept you so much longer than I said I would because this turned out to be so much more. I don't want to say interesting because I know you as an interesting person, but your health odyssey is just, I could have spent another hour on that alone. Oh, yeah. So, you have the Kinda Dating podcast. You're a writer on season 2 of Mr. Iglesias that's coming out on Netflix. You said this summer?
Yes, this summer.
Okay, so keep an eye out on Netflix for Mr. Iglesias. Or check out Gabriel Iglesias on social media and you can keep up with him and see updates about the show. Natasha posts about it as well. Where can people find you on social media?
I'm at Natasha Chandel on Instagram, Natasha_Chandel on Twitter, Natasha Chandel Official on Facebook. I'm more on Instagram and Twitter. And then the podcast is at Kind of Dating on all your
handles.
Kind of Dating on all the socials, and then on all podcasts.
And we'll have a link platform in the program notes as well to both Natasha and Kind of Dating's social handles. I can't thank you enough for coming on today. I'm certainly open if you ever want to have me on to talk about chronic disease and the capacity of dating. That sounds super interesting. And I'm warmed to hear that you've been getting feedback from people who are looking for that kind of material. And that tells me that there are people out there with disabilities and health challenges who are feeling a little isolated, alone, like they're having an experience they're struggling with, and knowing that they can turn to someone like you. As someone who also puts podcasts and content into the world, hoping that, as you said, I can entertain and maybe enlighten or empower in some way, I'm glad to know people are finding their way to you.
Thank you. We all got to be in it for each other, you know?
Yeah, it's a team effort, this life. All right, thanks, Natasha.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Natasha. Check out the Kinda Dating podcast. She's smart, funny, her guests are good, and they talk about dating. What's not to like? Season 1 of Mr. Iglesias is on Netflix right now. Catch season 2 this summer. And you can go watch Natasha and I act in Baker's Dozen, available on Amazon Prime right now. Takeda is our presenting sponsor. Thanks again for that. BleedingDisorders.com. To learn more, please rate, review, share, and subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast wherever you listen. Help us continue growing this show. It's doing really, really well, and I want to keep that going. Connect with Bloodstream Media or me, Patrick James Lynch, on social media, and we will speak to you again very soon. Until then, take self-care of yourself.